Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on the club's YouTube channel. I'm Dennis Wu, past chair of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors and a member of the Board of Directors of the Committee of 100. I am your chair for today's program. This program has been co-organized by the Committee of 100, established in 1990 as a nonprofit organization. The Committee of 100 has a rich legacy of harnessing the power of its distinguished memberships to address significant complex issues pertaining to Americans of Chinese descent and U.S.-China relations. And now on to the program. With China's growth slower than it has been in 25 years, it is undoubtable that China is experiencing an economic slowdown. The government has made changes to stabilize the situation and move the economy towards a new norm. Today, we'll discuss the different kinds of reforms China is working on and how likely those reforms are to succeed. What does it mean for Americans if those reforms succeed or if they fail? Do we need to fear a stronger China, or even so, a weaker one? It's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speakers. Yin-Yi Chan is Dean and Professor of the School of Economics and Management at Tsinghua University in China, a post he has held for 10 years. Professor Chan was born in Beijing and graduated from Tsinghua University. He received his PhD in economics from Harvard University after earning a master's in Management Science, Operations Research from Yale University, and a MA in Statistics from Columbia University. He has been on the faculty at Stanford, the University of Maryland, and the University of California, Berkeley. His main research areas include comparative economics, institutional economics, economics of transition, and the Chinese economy. Nicholas Lardy is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and a board member of Asia Policy and the China Review. Before joining the Peterson Institute in March 2003, Dr. Lardy was senior fellow at Brookings Institution. Before Brookings, he served at the University of Washington, where he was the director of the Henry M. Jackson School of International Studies, and before that, as adjunct professor of international trade and finance at Yale University. Dr. Lardy received his PhD in economics from University of Michigan and is a noted expert on the Chinese economy. Moderating today's discussion will be George Lewinsky, former editor of Marketplace Radio. George Lewinsky is well regarded for his coverage of international business and economic issues on U.S. public radio. Much of his reporting on Marketplace involved the growing relationship between the U.S. and Asia, particularly China. Mr. Lewinsky also served as a lecturer at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism, where he taught radio reporting for more than a decade. Previously, Mr. Lewinsky served as foreign editor and producer for the Canadian Broadcasting Company's radio and television news divisions. He received his BA in history from McGill University. Please welcome Professor Yin-Yi Chan, Dr. Nicholas Lardy, and George Lewinsky.
Thank you very much, Dennis, and thank you to all of you for coming this evening. When China starts to slow down, commodity-producing countries all over the world start to feel it. You know, ask Canada, ask Brazil. Both had recessions, and Canada certain, and both actually had changes of government partly as a result of the economic slowdown. If China's economy slows further from 6.5 or so percent down to say 5 or even 4, what will be the effect on the U.S.? Some observers are still warning that there will be a hard landing in China. A hard landing, for those of you who don't know, means basically a high-flying economy that's growing rapidly and strongly, falls precipitously, its growth falls precipitously, and it slips into recession. Very often, for those of you, again, who don't know, this is caused by the central bank tightening the money supply to fight inflation. Since inflation is only 2% a year, more or less, in China at the moment, I'm wondering whether the idea of a hard landing in China is still current. Professor Chang.
I want to start from a little more elaboration about the notion of soft landing and hard landing, because I think this is one of the key concepts here. I feel that very often that people discuss this issue that could be misleading. Here is what I think. When economists talk about soft landing and hard landing, we usually refer to the previous case that there's an overheated economy. And then the particular case is Chinese economy in the mid-1990s. In 1993, 94, there was inflation, there was very high growth, and that led to the so-called soft landing in 1996 and 1997 and 1998. That is the case we call soft landing. But today we talk about China's economic slowdown. It's not in that sense, because this is a long-term trend instead of a cyclical change. Therefore, it is a slowdown because China now no longer a poor, low-income country. Instead, it is a middle-income economy. So the slowdown is true, but I would not call that either soft landing or hard landing. So the notion that we use is slightly different from that.
A lot of people are talking about China's heavy debt. Bank of International Settlements, which worries about these sort of things, says that the growth of debt in China is greater than the growth in the economy. Fitch and other rating agencies say 15% to 20% of all loans in China are non-performing. Professor Lardy, isn't that worrisome?
Well, there has been really an unprecedented buildup of debt over the last 5 years. Remember, China began a very aggressive program at the onset of the global financial crisis in order to keep economic growth at a fairly reasonable pace. And this was financed mostly with bank credit. They didn't increase the government budget or outlays to the budgetary system. They increased credit through the banking system. So there was a huge increase and continues to be a very large increase in bank credit. The question is whether or not this is a threat to the economy and could lead to a banking crisis. There are a lot of mitigating factors in China. China has a very high savings rate. Most of these loans are being financed with deposits. The ratio of loans to deposits is relatively low. And China's big systemically important institutions don't finance themselves through what is sometimes called the wholesale market, like Lehman Brothers and other institutions did in the United States. In other words, they're not going to be subject to a sudden stop where, although suddenly their creditors aren't going to roll over their money, bank deposits tend to be very, very sticky, and this is particularly the case in China. So the buildup of credit is a risk, but I don't think we're at the point yet where we're going to be talking about a financial crisis or a banking problems that contribute to a substantial slowdown in economic growth.
Professor Chen,
go ahead. Yes, because Professor Lardy wrote a very famous influential book in the late 1990s, China's Unfinished Revolution, which dealt with, at that time, the bad loan problems. How do you compare today's problem with those in 15 years or 20 years ago?
I think they're substantially less. In the 1990s, banks were not allowed to write off any bad loans. They just kept accumulating. In the current environment, bad loans are being written off every quarter, every year by most of the banks. So, and the banks are much more commercially oriented than they were back then. In those days, They lent their money almost entirely to state-owned companies. Today, they're lending a lot of money to private companies, and equally important, the banking system in China today is lending a lot of money to households, mostly for mortgages. And, for example, in the first half of this year, about 40% of all the new loans extended by the banking system went to households, and about 80% of that went for mortgages. You know, the United States could learn a lot from China. When they've been having, you know, property price increases, but if you want to buy a second or third house to speculate, you have to come up with a 50% down payment in most cities in most times. So if we had had rules like that in effect 10 years ago or 12 years ago, we wouldn't have had a big financial crisis in the United States. And the share of lending going to the household sector has even increased further in recent months. In August, for example, about 70% of all the new loans were going to the household sector. So the household sector is not very highly leveraged, and most of the money is in mortgages where the loan-to-value ratio is very, very low, certainly compared to Western economies that had problems associated with the property market, countries like Ireland, Spain, and the United States.
So clear sailing?
No, I think there are risks. They need to slow down the growth of credit. They can't do this instantaneously or overnight, but I think we've already seen a beginning of a slowdown in the second and third quarter of this year, and I think that will continue. They're very gradually tightening. Wang Yang, the Chinese vice premier, said that, you know, China's economy is like a big ship. If you turn the rudder suddenly, you know, you're likely to capsize. So they want to slow down the growth of credit, but I think they recognize that it can't be done precipitously.
And the day before yesterday, that we read from the newspapers that the government of Shenzhen and Guangzhou just required that the second house, second apartment, the down payment requirement increase to 70%. So that's one of the measures they are taking.
Okay. Speaking about a big ship turning, China is embarking on quite radical economic reforms right now. It's promising to raise per capita income to $10,000. It's going to try to move up the manufacturing chain, ladder less on low value goods and more goods and services based on science and technology. I'm wondering whether this is something that I know that you're training your students at Tsinghua to take advantage or to understand this new economy that's coming. Do you think that, tell me, what are your challenges that you have?
Well, there are many challenges. I think we'd better to put this, your question, into context. And China came a long way in the last 35, 37 years. And when I first came to the U.S. in 1981, China's per capita income was around $200. 20 years ago, even 15 years ago, that China's per capita GDP was below 1,000. And now, last year, almost $8,000. So it's a solid middle-income country. So like all middle-income countries and like all other East Asian economies like Japan, Korea, Taiwan, they have experienced earlier on, when you are at this stage, $8,000 or $10,000, you are a middle-income country, then your economy has to slow down. There's no, it's really a sign of maturity as compared to the past. So therefore, as being a middle-income country, middle-income economy is different from being a poor, low-income country. It's also different from advanced country like the U.S., like European, like Europe or Japan. These are advanced. U.S. is $50,000-$60,000 per person. So therefore, on the one hand, you still have room to mobilize resources, still need to build infrastructure. On the other hand, you cannot repeat the way of doing business 15 years ago, 20 years ago, in the 90s, at the time that the labor cost is so low.
So what kind of changes do graduates of business school have to have in their mindset about doing business?
That's right.
What's important?
Well, there are several things. One is that innovation, entrepreneurship become very important as compared to the past. And another very important element is globalization. For the last 3 years, every summer I took a group of our MBA, EMBA students, executive MBA students, to the Silicon Valley, to the Bay Area, because this is the place that these students are extremely interested in, because the Silicon Valley is the place from many Chinese students' point of view for innovation, for entrepreneurship. So therefore, they need to learn entrepreneurship, innovation, and have the global mind to do things. Mm-hmm. So these are the things were not there when I first became the dean 10 years ago, but so obvious now. It has to be learned in business school.
I mean, Professor Lardy and Professor Dr. Chen, if you would both answer this, there seems to be a large number of interests in China that are concerned about or are worried about how this reform process will affect them. State-owned enterprises, for one, sectors of the economy that are based on exports and who may have to rethink their business model. How important are these groups as a drag on any reform efforts?
Well, I think they're very important. Vested interests are a big source of a relatively slow reform process, particularly of state-owned enterprises. And as this economy transitions away from the traditional model based on a high level of investment, huge amounts of exports, towards a model that's based more on consumption and less on exports, there's a tremendous amount of adjustment going on. Firms are having to change their product mix. More firms are failing. New firms are arising to meet new demands. So this is, I would say, this is very much a market-driven economy in response to changes in the global environment and to changes within China itself. It used to be that investment was the main driver of growth. Now we're seeing the service sector is a main driver of growth. In terms of the influence on the global economy, China's kind of insatiable demand for metals and raw materials has diminished substantially. And one of the reasons commodity prices have softened over the last 5 years is that the demand from China has moderated substantially for most of these kinds of commodities. So there are big changes within China, and they translate into substantial changes in the global economy because China's the second largest economy in the world and the biggest trading economy in the world.
Dr. Chen?
Yes, I think one observation is that in the last couple of years, at least, economists talked less about SOE reforms, and for good reasons, because I think Professor Lardy wrote extensively on that. Basically, in the last 10 or 20 years, the share of the state sector declined very fast. The share of the private sector increased, expanded very, very fast, despite that many people complained the obstacles of developing private companies. In fact, you read the newspapers or read business journals, you find that people talk more about Alibaba, Tencent, than, say, China Mobile or ICBC. So that the latter two are state-owned enterprises, big, huge state-owned enterprises. In fact, ICBC or China Mobile used to be had their largest market value. But last month, Tencent, which is a private company, is now becoming the most valuable Chinese and Asia companies. So that really the change over the last decade.
Mm-hmm. Well, young Chinese, say 30 years of age, I work for for the state-owned telecommunications company. I'm not a tremendous high flyer, but, you know, I'm thinking of getting married. I'm thinking of, you know, I just scrounged a lot of money to get an apartment, you know, and I'm being told that the telecommunications industry is moving toward privatization. Why should I feel happy about that?
Well, the word privatization is not used in China. for good reason, not only for the political reason, but also from business point of view, it's not accurate because China is not privatizing these SOEs. Instead, the new companies emerging. A good example is Tencent. It invented WeChat only 3 years ago.
Social media,
the Chinese version of WhatsApp and Facebook Messenger, but with much more functions. You can use that to pay, you can use that to hail taxi, etc. So these are the where the young people want to join. In addition to that, last week I was in Shenzhen, visited two companies. These are the new startups. One of them is called DJI, which is making the drone for consumer market. Drone has the 70% of the world market. The other is the Geno company, BGI. In both companies, the average age of employees by accident the same, 27. So that is how these young people, they want to be there. So if you look at the China Mobile, used to be so powerful, but now with WeChat, it's no longer that powerful. Mm-hmm. Without privatization.
Without privatization.
Yes.
Professor Lardy, you've been somewhat critical of the way the Chinese government has been handling the state-owned enterprises, not by making them bigger than they are now. Can you explain why that's consolidating them is a mistake?
Yeah. Well, one of the major initiatives of state-owned enterprise reform is to merge various enterprises together that are in the same sector. These are mergers, what I call mega mergers, that are being orchestrated by the planning agencies in the Chinese capital. These are not a private company thinking I can take over this company and use the assets more efficiently to generate higher profits, more productivity. These are what I call the top-down mergers, where somebody above is deciding we're going to merge these companies together. The problem is China's been doing this for 10 years, and it hasn't really been very effective. And I think as reflected, for example, in the fact that the productivity of these merged enterprises actually turns out to be less than the predecessor enterprises. So their profitability, their return on assets has actually gone down, and they're actually earning far less than the cost of capital. So I think they're clearly a drag on China's economic growth. Now, why does this happen? Well, I think essentially what you're doing is you're taking industries that have a handful of firms, so they already have a kind of oligopolistic market structure, and you're merging the biggest firms together, and you're making it a monopolistic market structure. And the incentive for innovation and product improvement and better, higher efficiency just goes out the window because there's very little competition. And that's what happened in the decade under the previous Chinese leadership of Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao, that these firms were merged together and they produced poorer and poorer economic results. Well, there was a bit of a hiatus, and now the new leadership, Xi Jinping and Li Keqiang, are taking the same approach. And there's not much evidence that I can see that they've really focused on the fact that this hasn't worked in the past. Instead, they seem to be obsessed with creating what they call national champions. And the definition of a national champion is to be bigger. China brags about the fact that the number of Chinese companies that are listed on the Fortune 500 list of the 1,000 biggest companies has increased dramatically. Well, remember, the list is based on revenue. How much, what's your revenue? What you really should be looking at is some measure of efficiency. How much profits are you earning? What's the return on assets or the return on equity rather than just looking at kind of top-line revenue? Because if you merge companies together, obviously top-line revenue is going to grow. But whether or not bottom line performance improves is a completely different question. So I think what they should be doing is taking moves to increase competition, to reduce the availability of credit to money-losing companies. As you mentioned at the outset, George, a large number of companies don't have enough cash flow to pay the interest on their loans. These companies should be forced to sell assets. Yes, Inge's exactly right. China doesn't talk about privatization. But these poorly performing companies, to repay their loans, should be forced to sell assets. These big state companies have massive amounts of assets. So if they can't perform, they should be forced to sell assets, and that would accelerate this shrinking process that Professor Chen already mentioned has been so important, such an important aspect of SOE reform over the last 30 years.
So basically you are saying that China grows despite these mergers of SOEs,
yes.
Not because of that.
So I think if they didn't have the mergers, they'd grow faster.
Could be, or more efficient.
Yeah.
There are stories now in the newspapers here, and I'm sure there are in China, rumors about severe disagreements at the upper echelons of the of government about which way to proceed, whether one goes full tilt toward economic reform or does one continue to some ways moderate the economic slowdown by pumping money into the system. How seriously do you take these reports? And, you know, are these reports true?
It's very hard to say because we read these reports from the sources from overseas as well. So therefore, we don't know. We cannot make any assessment. But I think there
Would the Chinese media report disagreements anyway?
Well, a lot of reports, if you read the business, finance, newspapers and magazines like Caijing or Caixin, mm-hmm. these are things we read, a lot of different opinions on that. There's always, not now, but if you look at the history of the last 20 or 30 years, always there's a trade-off or balance or tension between maintain growth rate and structural reform. Everywhere in the world, even in this country as well. So there is a trade-off between short-term and longer-term. So I remember that Larry Summers wrote an op-ed page last November talking about China needs to have more structural reform, but that requires even slower growth. Well, the commodity market does not like that. And many people in the outside China actually don't like it. In fact, I find that people outside China cares more about China's growth rate than people inside China. The reason is very simple, because the inside China, Chinese have to bear all the costs of high growth. But people outside China, they can only get the benefit from high growth because the commodity prices will be high. So therefore, I think if you look at the Chinese preferences, they prefer to have a cleaner air, a bit slower, and more stable growth rather than very high growth rate. Mm-hmm. By the way, now the growth rate 6% sounds very low, but remember, this is the economy is so big, much bigger than 10 years ago, maybe three times bigger than 10 years ago. So 6% growth on that base is more than 12% growth 10 years ago.
Professor Lardy, does do reports of disagreements in the highest levels of Chinese worry American investors, worry American policymakers?
Well, I think, again, putting things in context, there have been debates continuously for the last 35 years about the details about economic reform. Different people have different points of view. And I think, quite frankly, it's one of the healthy things about China that they do have these debates. Now, they're not always completely open and it's not completely transparent, but it's not unreasonable when you're trying to reform a centrally planned economy that has operated under a completely different system. You're trying to transition to a different model, that there could easily be quite understandable disagreements about how fast to proceed or what the sequence of reform should be. So those debates, I think, are actually fairly healthy. I think at the current time, particularly last summer when there was the big correction in the stock market and then some uncertainty a little less than a year ago about what they were doing with the exchange rate, that there was a lot of uncertainty generated by disagreements, and there wasn't enough clarity about what the direction was with respect to the stock market or with respect to the exchange rate. And a lot of people at that time were very pessimistic and thinking that this was the height of the period where people thought China was heading for a crash or a hard landing. I think now, in retrospect, we see that it wasn't as bad as was perceived, that yes, there were some disagreements, but we have much more clarity now on what their policy is. And I think the fear of a hard landing or crash is much less. So I think, when they devalued the currency by less than 2% in the summer of 2015, there was widespread spillover effects into global markets. You know, when the currency fell by a couple percentage points a few months ago, there was almost no reaction. People were looking at Brexit and a whole series of other issues, and they were not overreacting to a change, a relatively small change in the value of the Chinese currency. So I think we're in a somewhat more stable period than we were back then.
There have also been reports that the anti-corruption campaign, which has been going on for more than a year, a couple of years now, has had a deleterious effect, a bad effect on the bureaucracy to the sense that nobody wants to make any big decisions because they're afraid. They're frozen, paralyzed like deer in headlights. Can you comment on that, Professor Chang?
Well, people are certainly more cautious than before. That's true. So that actually the anti-corruption already almost 4 years, mm-hmm. So more than a couple of years. So people are trying to avoid risk, so the more it takes longer time to make decisions. But on the other hand, from my experiences that I visited several cities, the government officials still work very hard. For example, Shenzhen is the case, but it's not a typical city in China, but it is a very, very good performing city. A week ago, we met the mayor, that he seems to be as busy as before, making all kinds of decisions. People are certainly more cautious. So there are two effects here, that in the past, people are less cautious, so people make quick decisions. You have a good decisions, you also have bad decisions. But now people are more cautious. That's true. So there are some effect there, but we don't know whether this is the net effect. Yes.
Let me just say, I think this argument, which you hear over and over again, it lacks a little bit of credibility, because one of the things that bureaucrats have to approve is infrastructure projects. The state takes the lead in building high-speed rail, new metro systems, sewage systems, water supply systems, roads, et cetera, and Chinese investment in infrastructure is proceeding at a very, very rapid pace. So I think that in many cases, the bureaucrats have figured out how to keep these projects moving forward. So the idea that they're all sitting on their hands and doing nothing just doesn't compute with the fact that infrastructure investment is continuing to grow at a very, very high pace.
I've got to do a little commercial now. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we're discussing China's economic slowdown and its influence on the U.S. Our guests are Professor Yingyi Chan of Tsinghua University in China and Dr. Nicholas Lardy of the Peterson Institute for International Economics. I'm George Lewinsky, your moderator. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio and catch up with the program videos on the club's YouTube channel. Right now, I'd like to start with some questions from the audience. I have many of them. I don't know if we'll get through all of them, but I'd like to begin. Professor Chan, what are your feelings about the loans that are outside the informal banking system in China? How significant do you think they are, or are they mostly overblown by the media?
Well, I read many reports. There are different estimates. So I cannot cite the numbers there. They range from low to high. But I think these research reports started a few years ago, not now, so at least two or three years ago. Many researchers did very good jobs on that. I think that the question asked Professor Lardy early on, exactly what I have in mind, is that as compared to earlier periods in late 1990s or early 2000, China's banking system is in a much better position than those days. So China went through these late 1990s and early 2000. I think it's the banking system is in a better position to deal with the so-called shadow banking problems.
For Professor Lardy, this question, China's economy, which accounts for 39% of world GDP, is important to the world. What can the U.S. do to make sure China is doing well instead of treating China as a part of a zero-sum competition?
Well, I quite frankly, I'm of the view that U.S. leverage on this question is actually fairly limited. The key questions, key decisions are being made in Beijing about the pace of reform, which will influence the pace of growth. I think at the margin, the U.S. has been encouraging things that should be helpful, a more flexible exchange rate, for example, which has been one of the talking points of several of our Treasury secretaries in recent years. U.S. government officials have also been encouraging China to proceed on this transition to more consumption-led growth and less reliance on investment and exports. What effect this has on Chinese decision-makers is not clear to me, but I certainly think we're advocating things that would be helpful. And beyond those two fundamental things, I think the fact that the United States is trying to conclude a bilateral investment treaty with China, which would substantially liberalize certain parts of the economy where the state role is still very substantial, particularly in the service sector. Again, that would help to improve efficiency in the service sector if you had more competition, in part coming from private companies. So I think the idea of moving ahead with a bilateral investment treaty is, again, an initiative. Well, it's coming from both sides. I hope this agreement would be ultimately concluded and ratified, but the negotiation has been quite protracted. But I think that's another helpful thing that the United States is doing.
Another question, I think, for both of you. Two critical elements in China's growth were the growth of or the increase in the working age population until the latter half of the 20th century. And productivity gains, which in the past, again, were fueled by labor workers moving from the countryside to urban areas. What is the outlook for those two factors, that is, the working age population and the movement of people from the countryside to the cities?
Starting 2012, the share of working age worker labor as percentage of population started to decline. And starting 2013, the absolute number of the working age labor actually also declined. So no longer the case in the past 30 years that China had the so-called population dividends, no more. The good news is that for the short term, that made the unemployment issue less important because there is a so-called sort of labor shortage. Of course, there are structural problems there, but the numbers is declining. So therefore, in the short run, that the pressure for employment is not still there, but not as big as before. The productivity growth issue is the key. The government, economists, everybody understand this is will be the key for the continued growth. The major criticism for the past for the government policy since 2008, for this huge investment, is the declining of total not just the labor productivity, but the total factor productivity because of this huge investment. So now the government shifts the attention to innovation. But everybody understands it will take much longer time. So education, innovation become this is the new catchwords for the government policy. In addition to, so another, the one that mentioned is the new normal. But what behind the new normal is the new, they call it the driving forces. The new driving forces is more innovation-driven development.
Professor Lardy, do you?
Well, a lot of people are arguing that, you know, the shrinkage of the working age population is going to have a big deleterious effect on China's growth, and I agree with Professor Chen, and that is that if you look back over the last 30 or 35 years, the growth of the labor force has been significant in absolute terms, but it has not been the most important source of economic growth in China. The most important source of growth of China has been productivity growth. And so the question is, can China continue to have, well, actually, productivity growth has declined a bit in recent years, but can you get a resumption of productivity growth in order to keep economic growth fairly high? The second thing I would mention is that it will be possible to partially offset this reduction in the working age population by having people work longer. China's retirement ages, 55 for women and 60 for men, were set back in the 1950s when life expectancy was about 20 years less than it is now. And not only has it not been adjusted upward, many people finagle the system in ways they don't fully understand, and they retired long before the official retirement ages. The government, at least to my knowledge, for the first time publicly has started talking about raising the retirement age. So there is some potential for partially offsetting the decline in the working age population by having people work longer, which would not be such a hardship in an environment where people are retiring very early, an environment where life expectancy in China is within 1 or 2 years of the U.S. It's very close,
right.
Very high life expectancy, more than 20 years higher than when the retirement ages were fixed. So that may be another possible offsetting effect of the drag of the slower growth of the working age population. And on the migration part of the story, this is controversial, but there's, you know, the rural population is still relatively high, and some people think migration will slow down. Some people think it will pick up, but at least about half the population still is tied to rural areas, and I think that will inevitably decline as we move forward. So the migration story has not ended. China is far from being a highly urbanized society, and there's still an enormous productivity difference between people working in rural agricultural activities and those who move to the cities and move into modern industry or services. The gap is huge, something like 3, 4, 5 to 1. So as you continue this migration, it has a very positive effect on economic growth. So migration's not over, and the working age population problem can be partly offset by extending the, raising the retirement age.
I think I agree that I just want to add that in order to have more people moving from the agricultural or rural area to the urban area, that requires a lot of more reforms in the public goods provision, in education, healthcare, all these things that are related to the attached to being in the urban area. So a lot of reforms really required if that can happen. So
another question: where does the Chinese government get the revenue it needs to support the economy if the state-owned enterprises are in a period of decline? Do the newer companies pay taxes? Is there an income tax in China?
Well, the major tax is VAT, value-added tax. U.S. does not have that. The equivalent will be sales tax. But this is at the national level. This is the major tax. It started 20 years ago. That started in 1994. And income tax is, in comparison, is much less important than VAT or value added tax, which is indirect tax.
And corporate tax.
But in comparison, value added tax is the most important.
I think another key thing is that the government has, you know, the private sector has become more and more important over the last couple of decades. And during this period, tax revenues have actually increased as a share of total output. So this idea that the government depends on SOEs, these state companies, to generate revenue for the Ministry of Finance is not a very sound argument. Value-added taxes are being paid by all types of corporations, regardless of their ownership. And revenue relative to output has increased as the share of output being produced by state companies has fallen.
Perhaps because we're here in the Bay Area, a lot of questions on real estate. What will be the real estate market prospect in China's big cities? Will prices continue to grow? Will they moderate or will they collapse? And this is for you, Professor Chang.
Well, for those economists in the past 20 years, they predicted that the housing price will come down. All of them so far were wrong. So, of course, I never make any predictions about housing prices in China because I knew it could be wrong. So, but as economists, we all believe that it's very hard to believe. I've been spent many years, 15 years in the Bay Area. I know this is the area that housing prices are very high compared to the rest of the country, of the U.S. But in Beijing, it's very hard to believe that 1 square foot cost about, on average, about $1,000.
Square foot,
$1,000. So that tells you that that's too high. And again, talking about housing prices, there are four-tier cities in China. First tier, second tier, third tier, fourth tier. So the two extremes. In the first, now, together with the second tier, the housing prices are too high.
So these are first tiers.
First tier are basically three cities, Beijing, Shanghai, Shenzhen, first tier. And then second tier, you have Hangzhou, you have Guangzhou, you have some other big. And then the rest, you have third tier, smaller cities, and fourth tier, the county seats, cities. And very different is the first and second tier cities, the prices, the housing prices, very high. But the third and the fourth tiers, you have a huge number of inventories, unsold apartments. So it's not just one market. There are segmented many markets there.
China talks about an innovation China talks about innovation, but in any innovative country, there's the rule of law, freedom of expression, and free movement of people. With that background, how can China innovate with the type of government it has now?
Well, that's a very good question that many people ask, many people from this country will ask. I think the movement of people, that's pretty free in China. That's one of the advantages over the, for the past 35 years is the movement of people. For I give you one example that not just the moving from rural to urban, but moving across provinces. For example, people talk a lot about the problem of Northeast China, the three provinces that growth is very low. In fact, one of the reasons is that a lot of people moving from Northeast China to South China, to Shenzhen or to Guangdong, to other places. Mm-hmm. So that's actually is the evidence of movement of people. Second, about freedom of speech and expression, about that question. In terms of technical innovation and business model innovation, there are a lot of room and freedom there. So Chinese understand very well where is the limit. So if you only focus on technical and business model innovation, there is no restrictions there. But if you discuss political, ideological issues, there are restrictions there. So therefore, it's not just a one-dimensional thing. Of course, these might be related. However, to a large extent, they seem to be, to some extent, can be separated.
I'd just like to come in on that. I agree with Inge very much. You have to separate the economic from the political. In the economic domain, there's a great deal of debate, and the private sector is very vibrant. And in terms of rule of law, you know, you wouldn't want to stand up in Tiananmen Square and say to overthrow the Communist Party. But they have a very effective rule of law on enforcing economic contracts. They have a lot of economic courts, millions of disputes. Obviously, it's the second biggest economy in the world. Inevitably, there are going to be a lot of disputes between buyers and sellers, between different firms and so forth and so on. They have a very effective system for dealing with these in their legal system. As I say, you wouldn't want to be charged with some political offense because you might get a hard time, but millions of disputes get settled. Basically, this is a contract law. These contracts get enforced. So I think that supports an environment in which you can have innovation by entrepreneurial firms.
Agree.
Right.
Unfortunately, reached the part of our program where we only have room for one last question. And I'm going to ask you both. The question comes from the audience. Who do you think China wants as president, Trump or Clinton?
Very good question. In fact, if you look at the internet portals, or you look at these online discussions, there are more attention paid to Donald Trump than Clinton.
In the media here, too.
Oh, here, okay. I think for many, many different reasons. He's a very unusual candidate. He's entertaining and saying something people don't hear otherwise. So there are a lot of interest there. But I don't know whether what are the serious thoughts behind that. It's not clear because these the young people in China, they like to be part of these interesting discussions, but it's not. They don't vote anyway, so they can say whatever they want.
Well, I think one thing to notice is that at the official level, I don't think there's been much commentary. I mean, high-level officials in China are not saying anything that reflects a preference for one candidate over the other. So Inge's talking about what's happening at the popular level, but I think at the leadership level, they've been meticulous about not saying anything that could possibly be interpreted as favoring one candidate over the other. So, what the real thoughts are, I think anybody's entitled to a guess. If I were guessing, they have a history of not liking Hillary ever since she went to that women's conference in, 1992 or something like that, in which she made a number of comments which were not very well received by the Chinese leaders. So I think she starts with a handicap, but I have to believe that despite that, they would probably prefer her over Donald Trump, because Donald Trump is talking about massive changes that would be very, very disadvantageous for China. He's talking about, reducing the U.S. military commitment in Asia, and that the South Koreans and the Japanese should all get nuclear weapons. This is not something the Chinese are looking forward to. So I think China would go for Hillary. She's the lower risk candidate.
But both candidates have been hard or say they're going to be hard on trade. Trump obviously, made that almost the centerpiece of his campaign, and Mrs. Clinton has moved that way too. What do you both think that about the trade policies of the two candidates?
Well, over the years, the Chinese developed this perception about the U.S. Election is that during the campaign you can say whatever you want to say, but after you become president, you don't actually do what you say. So therefore, it's a cynical view, but many Chinese, ordinary Chinese, they truly believe that. So they don't, to them, there's no difference between what you say during the campaign. Mm-hmm. That's my take. Right. Of the,
well, my view on this would be that I think the Chinese recognize that they have benefited enormously from the expansion of their participation in the global economy, their expansion of trade, their ability to attract foreign investment, which they've been doing on a very large scale for several decades. More recently, their ability of some of their better firms to invest abroad in Europe, in the United States, and elsewhere. So they're not going to go out campaigning for globalization, but they recognize that China has benefited from it. And I think, again, the risks are that with Trump proposing to put 45% tariffs on Chinese goods, which would destroy a significant portion of the Chinese economy, 35% tariffs from Mexico, withdraw from the WTO, tear up all these agreements, that globalization would be dealt an enormous setback. The United States almost certainly would go into recession, which is also not very good for China since we're one of their largest markets. So again, I think on a risk aversion basis, they have to prefer Hillary's trade policies to Trump's. Mm-hmm.
I think the Chinese benefited enormously from opening up from globalization. I think that's a consensus. And globalization, unlike many other parts of the world, in China, globalization is a very good word. Protectionism is a very bad word. So this is both at the official level and also at the ordinary people level.
So Clinton is preferable.
I won't say that. I don't know. You say from the government point of view or from the
government point of view.
From the government point of view. And
it's not clear. Yeah.
It's not clear. So. Okay. We do have a bit more time, so I'm just going to ask you one more question, which, again, comes from someone who obviously lives here. Says that California is the one of the largest, the seventh largest economy in the world. As China slows down, what effect will it have on the economy in this state?
Well, I think the Chinese love California, period, for a variety of reasons. You know, when I was a student, we all say that if you are the Chinese student, if your first stop is East Coast, you could move to California. But if your first stop is California, you never leave California. Okay, so there are a lot of reasons for that. But now, in addition to that, people feel that geographically is closer and there are also larger Chinese population here, there's an added reason now. Is related to this slowdown and structural change and more innovation-driven economy. So that becomes the new orthodox in China. But if you want to emphasize more on innovation entrepreneurship, it is California. It's the Bay Area. It's the Silicon Valley. So therefore, I think now the big change from say 10 or 15 years ago, is that there are now two ways of exchange between China and California. Not just that the Chinese learn from the Silicon Valley firms, but also they also invest in the Silicon Valley. One example is Baidu. Baidu has a research center here employing 200 people, which is a very large operation to research on very high-tech stuffs, like deep learning type of thing. So there will be a huge integration between California and the China, not the whole country, but parts of the country that is moving at the frontier, like Shenzhen, like Shanghai, like Beijing.
So, but if China is moving toward an innovation society, clearly parts of China become a competitor to Silicon Valley.
Well, not yet, because think about that still, that people, you know, from my experiences, that because I take Chinese entrepreneurs and students come to the Silicon Valley, they still feel that there's a lot can be learned from Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. So perhaps in the future, the model will be that the very original research and development will be done in the Silicon Valley, But the later stage of development, in particular, that those development relevant to the market will be in China, and China has a huge market. So that type of integration, I do see, is emerging.
Professor Lardy?
Well, I agree with Inge. I think there are a lot of complementarities in this high-tech area, in the innovation, and I think it should be a win-win for California and for big parts of China, the places Inge mentioned, Hangzhou, other places that have innovative firms in China.
So the United States basically should not be afraid of a China reforming, becoming a world power and not a regional power.
Well, if you look at the economy, I just look at this before I came here, I look at the statistics that U.S. economy is still the largest in the world, about 23% of the world GDP, and China last year was about 60% of the U.S. That increase from 10 years ago, 10 years ago, 2005, was only 17% of the U.S. So last 10 years, really a huge change. So therefore, these two economies account for about 36%. Very soon, will account for maybe 40% of the entire world. And there are a lot of complementarities between the two economies. So I do think that it's not the word fair is the right description here. I think there's a lot of collaborations in the future, and we'll see. We see already it's happening now that I think Alibaba, Baidu, all these companies, Tencent, have the investments in the Silicon Valley, in the Bay Area, and Uber from the city that now integrated with the Chinese Didi company. So therefore, we'll see more and more of this happening. I think 2016 is the year that will be remembered for a lot of these interactions.
Mm-hmm. Good. Our thanks to Professor Yingqi Chan of Tsinghua University in China and to Dr. Nicholas Lardy of the Peterson Institute for International Economics. We also thank everyone here as well as our audience on radio, television, and the internet. Tonight's program has been co-organized by the Committee of 100. I'm George Lewinsky, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.